This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri mark a year of intense struggle since the death of Michael Brown. But what is the state of the movement? A U.S. embassy opens in Havana, Cuba, and Haiti holds its first elections in 4 years. But first, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations holds its national conference in Philadelphia this weekend under the theme, Black Power Matters, Black Community Control of the Police. The Milwaukee chapter of the Black National Defenders is part of the Black Is Back Coalition. Organizer Americus Levine says the Black National Defenders, or BND, envision one day replacing the police altogether.
Black National Defenders, we actually just launched March 1st of this year is when we decided, when we made it official. We started with what's called a 20 Hoods, 20 Blocks. And what we did is every Saturday we went to the worst neighborhoods and we pretty much rallied, went to the doors, introduced ourselves to the people. And within these marches, when you're going through the hood, we had experiences where we were meeting people who been shot or just shot someone, or, you know, both sides, actually. And while that happened, one time, one of the brothers who joined our march, joined our rally, was murdered the night before. And we went to his vigil, and his mother was there. And we had a vigil, his family, and we were there. And at that time, whoever shot him came back and shot at the vigil, and it hit his mom. And it was in that moment that, after they left, the police came and immediately tried to attack the people, because, of course, they see all of us as criminals. None of us are ever victims. So they tried to attack the people. And BND, Black National Defender, we pretty much became that line between the people and the police. And we had the people stand back, and we told the police were trying to make everyone go in the house and go home and pretty much try to tackle people. But we got in between and said, you know, you can't talk to anyone. That it came to the point where the police told us, well, can you control your people, as if we work for them? But it came to the point where they respected us because we were in uniform. We were very serious about them not communicating with the people. Let us communicate with the people. And what came from that is we created like a hotline so people can call if they don't want to snitch, quote unquote, and see how we can also do block treaties and gang treaties, which is what we're doing. We have actually reached the head of the Bloods here and the head of the Crips here to organize peace within the two groups so that they can give further insight on how things should be ran now within the organization and with the people outside.
Your group isn't just calling for changes in how the police behave in Milwaukee. You're working towards creating the conditions in which the community replaces the police force as we know it.
Yeah, we would like to replace the police, and it's something that just has to be done. And it can be done. I think that we have people who call us instead of calling the police. We have like a mother, but the people don't know if we don't go to the homes, which is why we go every week to the neighborhood so the people can know to call us. We had an incident with a lady. She called us because her son, you know, was very angry. And instead of calling the police, she called us. We were able to come to her house, calm the son down, and take him somewhere else. And it just, we don't have to ask for that. We can just do these things. But we need the people, we need the power, and we just have to let the people know. We don't have to ask to replace them. These are things that we can do ourselves.
Yes, because as every Black family knows, if you call the police about a family problem, you're probably going to wind up with a dead family member.
Absolutely, absolutely, which we have seen happen plenty of times. And we were able to remove her son, and that was a very feel-good moment. And it was a small victory, but it meant a lot. Because the brother, he was just very upset and, of course, got into an argument, like families do, any family. But when you call the police and bring them into a situation, they automatically, for one, looking at both of you guys as criminals, never as people first. You already looked as a problem before you ever looked as a person. and he could have got a record, which could have stopped it. Just more on top of stuff when we can handle things ourselves. And this brother didn't know who we were. We met his mother from just doing marches and going through the neighborhood. And that felt so good to her that she really believed us. And that takes a lot to get your people. This wasn't a conscious woman. This was just a woman who just felt us and decided to give us a chance. And she gave us a shot, and we did not let her down. And that really meant a lot. It really did.
So how are you going to build on this momentum?
Putting the word out. That's the only way, and that's how I envision it. Keep going, continuing the footwork, putting the boots on the ground, and putting in the work. Because the work is going to come by itself, but you have to get out there in order for it to happen. We have to build, recruit more people who want to take on this duty. Because granted, we're not getting paid for this. This is just a duty within ourselves that we owe to our people. So it's just finding the people who are committed, not people who are in the movement, but people where the movement are in them, because then we can be out there more than once a week. And we can have different people doing different shifts or work in different neighborhoods, but we have to build the manpower. We have to build it.
So the Black National Defenders have a vision of Black people policing themselves from the ground up.
Oh, absolutely. And we're not only we're demanding it, we are putting in action and showing that it can be done. So others can demand it as well and demand it within themselves that this is what we're going to do. It definitely can happen. It's definitely something that's tangible and able to happen. We just have to do it.
How are other community organizations and Black elected officials in Milwaukee responding to the work that you're doing on the street?
When we first started doing the 20 Hood, because we tried to get all the organizations, all the different churches, the Nation of Islam, the Christian community involved. And the Nation of Islam here in Milwaukee, they're still coming every week, which is pretty good. But however, the Christian community, they just fall back and disappear because it becomes real when we're not relying for something to come out and save us, but we're actually doing the same as ourselves. So it's a big difference when you're taking on that responsibility. A lot of people talk it, but they don't walk in. And the elected officials, they're not really too fond of it, no. Because we have Sheriff David Clark here, which is always on CNN, always. He's the first coon they put in the spotlight. Black sheriff here, very ignorant man. Very ignorant man. And he ended up putting a warrant out for my arrest, saying that I was lead organizer here in Milwaukee, me and another brother here. But there wasn't any charge, so we had our attorneys. And he ended up calling and saying he was dropping the warrant until it was a further investigation. But he did that to slow us down. Because when the police came to the one neighborhood, we already had the hood out. It was already a vigil. A lot of Black people out. And when they swarm in the police like that, the people automatically see that's our enemy right there. Because we're for you. And we've been running through neighborhoods screaming, I love you. Yo, I love you too. I said, I love you. Yo, I love you too. And then you have the oppressors who come and looking at everybody as a problem, telling you to get out of streets that you pay taxes for, telling you to go in the house. We were able to bring that consciousness to the neighborhood and make them have a voice of their own and stand up. So, like, the sheriff does not like that. They want us to be quiet and just deal with our deaths and deal with our killings quietly. They just want us to stay out the street.
Americus Levine of the Black National Defenders in Milwaukee. Back in 2012, before most people had ever heard of Ferguson, Missouri, Black national anger focused on the killing of teenager Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. Philip Agnew emerged as a leader of the young activists' organization, the Dream Defenders. We asked Agnew for his assessment of the past year of struggle.
After Ferguson and during Ferguson and being able to be on the ground there, I was able to see a lot of different things from a different vantage point. I do think it's important that you noted that we predated the events in Ferguson, and the reason is not for any seniority badge, but frankly, the media firestorm and the celebrity culture and the mass amounts of money was something that was thrown at us a year before. And so we were able as an organization to, as participants and also as observers, kind of watch how easily movements can be co-opted, can be bought, leaders and spokespeople characters can be created. And for something that began very organically, that began very raw, that began unaffiliated, unbought, and unbought, can eventually be quite the opposite in just a short matter of time. We were able to, and I'm proud of this, and I'll say it on Mountain Top, we were able to make it through that with our integrity intact. And we've just been able in the year since to observe how different elements have been able to flourish, that have been helpful, that have been smart and strategic, and how other elements and other characters have been elevated just to really support a really reactionary view, separatist view, a sectarian view of liberation for poor people, for Black people in this country. This year has been a lot of reflection, a lot more analysis, a lot more introspection for myself, for the organization. And I also think it's just made us a lot stronger, a lot more nuanced, and pushed us to really, really investigate why we're really a part of this and what we really want to do and what our actions are doing is reflecting what we say.
How have your strategies and tactics changed over the past year or over the past several years?
I think overall, and moving forward, and even now, we've grown less and less and less concerned with people knowing about us and knowing what we're doing. I think the nonprofit celebrity culture that I have been a part of, that some would argue I'm still a part of, is a slippery, slippery, slippery slope, especially when the celebrity and notoriety is why you begin doing what you're doing. So we've become less and less concerned with that and the value of that for our lives and for our organizing. And so when you release that pressure and you allow yourself to really refocus and reanalyze and reground while you're doing your thing, the work becomes a lot actually more fun, a lot more intense, but a lot more fun. And so we've been focused on building deeper. What we're embarking on in the next 6 months that we haven't really talked about publicly is re-cementing our relationships in the places where we are and pulling in people who have not been a part of the movement, who have still been excluded from the conversation and from the movement.
Seems like you've been doing a lot of criticism, self-criticism in these months.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. When you're able to watch and see the same things that happen to you happen to other people, that warrants a little bit of introspection. I look at it like you're a little bit older, you're a little bit more wise, and you understand a little bit more, and you see a little bit more. And so, yeah, a lot of introspection. I think introspection is the reason that folks that are in this movement, the folks that are doing it, will last, because they're always analyzing whether they're doing what they say they want to do.
What do you mean going back to the place, the roots that you came from, and reaching people who you had not previously reached?
Well, the fact of the matter is, a lot of the stuff and the activity that's going on and the conversations that are going on and happening above the people who we're claiming that we represent, and I don't mean intellectually, these fights are being fought and waged in rooms and in places and in publications, maybe in forums that don't even exist to a lot of the people we claim to represent or claim to come from. So the actions that we take, getting arrested, protesting, interrupting things, can't be done by a lot of the people. And that doesn't mean we can't do it. Somebody's got to do it at some point. But we've also got to expose the political education, the political activity to communities, poor people, working class people who don't have the time to protest at noon because they got three jobs. How can they be exposed to not only the education, but the activity, the disruptive force, the power building force? And not to say we're doing it perfectly. This is a critique we have about our organization as well. How are we really building a revolutionary force of people who we claim are directly affected if all the activities that we do happen during the workday, all the language that we're using is out of some random text with good stuff in it, but doesn't speak to our folks? So we're analyzing that about ourselves, and that's the direction that we want to go in.
So you want to develop a real community base that deals with actual folks that you purport to be in service of?
Absolutely, absolutely. None of us in our organization are wealthy. We don't come from upper-class backgrounds. Most of us come from lower-class backgrounds. But we also have certain abilities and certain advantages, right, that allows for us to, specifically, I keep harping on this because it's based on a conversation that I just had yesterday with one of our members. We have the ability to get arrested because we're not also tomorrow going to look for a job somewhere in retail, et cetera, because we're working for our organization, or we've decided to make a jump from the quote-unquote corporate or retail world into the world of social justice. And, you know, this is our full-time thing. But for folks, if this isn't their full-time thing, they don't have the ability or the luxury, or they have children, they have homes, they have bills. How can we expand and be there for them?
And back to the subject of Ferguson, it seems that all of the political tendencies of Black America have somehow made their way to Ferguson and are part of the pageantry there.
And you know what? I think pageantry is an appropriate word. I would use patchwork. And the reason I would use that is just I met some amazing, amazing, amazing people and some amazing organizers while I was there. I met some creative, really savants, some people who really care. And I met some lifelong friends while I was there as well. Then also you got some characters. You got some people who looked on the internet and said, man, this is a place where I can make my name. This is a place where I can go crazy and do all the stuff I couldn't do at home. So I'm going to go out to Ferguson and do that. So yeah, a good mix of all of those, that patchwork of kind of the Black liberation movement. You had a lot of people, and I like to say, I think the majority of people who really cared, who wanted to do something, who wanted to build something, myself included, I was inspired by that. I've never thought I would see something like what I read about in Watson and Trenton and in New York and, you know, Chicago happen in my lifetime. So I wanted to see it. I wanted to be a part of it. And I think we had a lot of folks like that. And then there are other folks who something unsuspecting happened to them and they got wrapped up in all of the BS. And it's hard to get out of that sometimes when you're in that spin cycle.
From your assessment, do you think we have a movement that is worthy of the name yet, or how close are we?
I think we're building it there. I think more and more people are getting activated, and more people are becoming more aware. And I am encouraged by that. I think historically, our generation has one that's been one of comfort and sloth and assimilation. We're the product of the generation that fought to integrate, or many segments of it, the mainstream segment of it, fought to integrate, but we're the product of that. And so, yes, we are building towards that. But a movement, we're not there yet. I see more internationally than I'm able to call upon here, but I think we're moving towards a movement.
That was Philip Agnew of the Dream Defenders. In Ferguson, Missouri, last week, authorities declared a state of emergency after police gunfire left a young Black teenager critically injured. There was plenty of nonviolent resistance to mark the year since Michael Brown was killed by a Ferguson cop. Protesters gathered at the St. Louis County Jail demanding the release of Alexis Templeton and Brittany Farrell, leaders of Millennial Activists United, who'd been arrested earlier. Jaisal Noor, a producer for the Real News Network, spoke with Reverend Osegyefu Seku, an activist minister based in Massachusetts, and Father Mike Kinman, dean of the Episcopal Christ Church Cathedral in St. Louis. First, Reverend Seku talked about the growth of the mass movement over the past year.
I mean, the reality is that a new generation of leadership has emerged. It's our responsibility as clergy to stand with, defend Rasheem, Brittany, Alexis. The list can go on of young people. Father Mike was kind enough to allow his church to be used as a sanctuary for this movement. We marched out. We called on the Department of Justice to do its job and found ourselves in federal custody. Afterwards, it was part of a day-long actions of Moral Monday, and the work led by Mao, founded by Alexis and Brittany, continued that work of shutting down the highway. Over 100 people were arrested unconstitutionally, and so that is part of the fact that although we've seen little change in terms of public policy, everything that we've seen has been cosmetic, but we've changed. We are not going to bow down. We're going to support our young people and defend them at all costs. And it's a great moment to be alive. The best of the democratic tradition is alive. And we're going to continue to put our bodies on the line and stand in solidarity and follow the unique leadership of young Black queer women who have called the nation to account and demanded that they pay attention to the humanity of Black people.
And talk about the importance of having this gathering here and having this demonstration. We know at least 12 white demonstrators are in the front of this line. They've locked arms. they said they're prepared to be arrested in an act of civil disobedience.
Well, this is the reality that we've seen, in this moment from August 9th of 2014 to August 9th of 2015, we've seen many white allies become white freedom fighters. That it is more than just simply a conversation about their individual privilege or their individual resources. It has become more and more about that they understand that they have something spiritually and cosmically at stake in fighting white supremacy. And we've seen them transform over this time and space. And it's a beautiful moment in American democracy.
And I would add to that, when you think about what's actually going on here, people are talking about risking arrest because they are standing in a public space and desiring to enter a public building. There is no way that that should be an act that risks arrest. Reverend Sekou and 56 other people got arrested on Monday for trying to deliver a letter to a public official in a public building during public hours. This is a criminalization of the First Amendment. And it is being done selectively, and it is being done only to our black and brown brothers and sisters.
Father Mike Kinman of the Christ Church Cathedral in St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Cornell West, the public intellectual and activist based at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City, was among those arrested during last week's protests in Ferguson. He was also the keynote speaker at Greater St. Mark's Church.
Integrity. I didn't say cupidity, love of money. I didn't say venality. I didn't say timidity. Malcolm X is right. The time for sweet talking to powers that be is over. The time for being engaged in polite conversation that ties and conceal your rage is over. Oh, yes, once you look at our young folk and the tears of those precious folk, we got to be militant. It's the challenge of every generation. Is willing, whether you're willing to channel your righteous indignation and your moral outrage to love and justice or hatred and revenge. That's the question. And that's what the powers that be understand. That's why they love Martin King so. He's not going to do the same thing to us he did to him. That's why they were afraid of Malcolm X. That's why they didn't even know about the genius of Ella Baker. He was somewhere with Grand and the Pope of Grand Leader. Bella was always on the ground like Brother Sekou. We need a connection between activity on the street and what goes on in the streets. If you're only in the streets, there's a good chance you will sell out. No matter how much you pose and posture, how else are we going to account for the fact that every 28 hours for the last 3 years, some black child, brown child,
mama,
red sister, shot by a policeman on security guard. And yet you got a black president, a black attorney general, a black homeland security in the cabinet. And not one police goes to jail, only to the pressure put by the federal government.
Tell the truth, man. They don't want to hear that. Tell them. Tell them.
I told over and over again, all you got to do is vote. Vote, Negroes, vote. Oh, we should not have voted all right then. In comes the magnificent, charisma, brilliant black president who don't find his voice until 7 years to go to a prison. Huh. And that deodorant can't even see the prisoners when he gets there.
That's right.
And he only wants to talk to the non-violent ones. Black faces in high places don't always translate into justice or peace. Don't tell me what color you are. I want to know what color you think you are. I want to know what kind of vision you have. What kind of courage are you going to manifest? What cost are you going to pay? That's what we're here to talk about. I'm going to sit down. We're going to zero in on the church. And let us be honest that the Christian church in America has been an abysmal failure when it comes to dealing with the forsaken needs of poor people and working people and black people. And there once was a time when the black church was more friendly, and now we got mega churches and we don't have no mega church. Oh, yeah. We got CEO pastors rather than those who love the people.
Dr. Cornell West, the U.S. Embassy in Havana, Cuba, was officially opened for business last week. Secretary of State John Kerry was on hand for the occasion, marking the reestablishment of normal diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Dr. Gerald Horn is a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston and a prolific author. One of his recent books is titled Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. We asked Dr. Horn, what kind of relations can we expect between the imperial United States and socialist Cuba?
I think the analogy to be drawn is with the Haitian Revolution. It took roughly 58 years from 1804 to 1862. For the United States to recognize the Haitian Revolution. It took from 1959 to 2014-15, which is a shorter period of time to recognize the Cuban Revolution. You might consider that a sign of progress. The problem is that the machinations against Haiti actually, in some ways, escalated after recognition. It was after recognition, as I say in my forthcoming book, which will be out in a few weeks, Confronting Black Jacobins, the United States, the Haitian Revolution, and the Origins of the Dominican Republic, that it was after recognition that you saw an escalation of ships of U.S. slave traders sailing in Haitian territorial waters trying to kidnap Haitians and take them into slavery on Cuban slave plantations. Cuba didn't abolish slavery until the 1880s, as you know. And you also may recall that it was a few years before that, actually, in February 1844, that the United States, under then U.S. Secretary of State John C. Calhoun, the hawkish South Carolinian, succeeded in executing one of the early successes of U.S. covert intervention when the island was split. That is to say, that marks the origins of the Dominican Republic. And then what ensued after that were years of warfare between Haiti and the Dominican Republic, softening up Haiti, making it easier in 1870 for the United States to seek to annex the entire island and then turn Haiti into a state to which formerly enslaved U.S. Negroes would be rapidly deported. All of this, that is to say, the post-1862 relation between Haiti and the United States was somehow more complicated, some ways more complicated than the pre-recognition. That's a prelude to trying to understand that post-2015, at best, you can expect Washington to simply change its strategy to destabilize the Cuban Revolution. President Obama has said rather explicitly and clearly that the previous policy of destabilizing the revolution had not worked. So it's time for a new policy to destabilize the revolution. That's point number one. Point number two is that even though the U.S. press has portrayed this as an example of U.S. benevolence, that is to say, supposedly extending a lifeline to struggling Havana, actually this recognition fits in with the renewed geostrategy of U.S. imperialism. That is to say that Washington now has deteriorating relations with both Moscow and Beijing at a time when we are told by the U.S. press that Russian bomber planes can be found in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of California, when the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, when Moscow placed defensive missiles in Cuba to protect the revolution, which the United States stoutly objected to and almost brought the world to the brink of nuclear destruction, all of that is fresh in our minds. And at the same time, there are so many members of the Standing Committee of the Political Bureau of the Chinese Communist Party in and out of Havana, you would think that they had a second residence there. So this attempt to normalize with Havana has to be seen as a way to preempt Cuba from moving ever closer to Moscow or Beijing, which would be interpreted as compromising U.S. national security.
And of course, to go back to the Haitian comparison, in 1915, the U.S. goes in and occupies Haiti. Is this new embassy a new or renewed outpost of U.S. subversive activities in Cuba?
Well, certainly it'll be a nest of spies. It already is a nest of spies. And the fact that supposedly so-called dissidents were not invited to the flag-raising ceremony involving Secretary of State John Kerry, I'm not sure if that should be taken seriously. You are correct to point to the analogy of the Haitian occupation by U.S. imperialism circa 1915, which only ended circa 1934, and arguably Haiti has yet to recover from the devastation of that punishing and pulverizing occupation, which in many ways was more destabilizing than the Haitian earthquake, an earthquake which, as you know, has profited handsomely Bill and Hillary Clinton and their eponymous foundation, not to mention the U.S. Red Cross and other entities.
I was recently in Cuba after a 30-year absence, and all the Cubans that I was able to speak to could almost literally taste a lifting of the embargo. Is anxiousness for the embargo to be lifted a good bargaining position to be in for Cuba?
Well, keep in mind that the blockade, the embargo, is a separate legal and political matter. It will be difficult for the U.S. administration to unilaterally lift the most punishing aspects of the blockade, although there are some aspects that can be lifted by the U.S. administration, and obviously pressure has to be placed upon the U.S. administration to do so. Keep in mind as well that there will be ripple effects from this normalizing. Recall that before 1959, Cuba was a tourist magnet for the U.S. citizenry. After 1959 is when you began to see the expansion of Montego Bay in Jamaica and tourism of U.S. nationals to Bahamas, Barbados, etc. Given the proximity of the island to the North American mainland and given that history of being a tourist magnet pre-1959, I would hope that our friends in the Caribbean community, that is to say CARICOM, would be exploring what will be the impact of U.S.-Cuba normalizing on what has been, in recent years and decades, a prime prop of their economy, that is to say, tourism.
It was only a few years ago that the United States, through Dr. Carlos Moore, was deeply engaged in stirring up or trying to point to discontent among blacks in Cuba. Do you anticipate a revival of that campaign?
Well, sure. I foresee that as being part of the strategy. There's no question about it. But I think it's important to note, as I point out in my book, Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, that there is something of a difference between how Spanish colonialism approached the question of black folk and how the U.S. settler rebels who founded the United States of America approached the question. The latter, the U.S. settler rebels, of course, believed wholeheartedly in penalizing and pulverizing Africans at every opportunity, not least since they had rebelled against Britain because they thought Britain was moving towards the abolition of slavery. And, of course, the Africans were in favor of the abolition of slavery, which means that the African population in North America historically has been treated as if it were an enemy of the state, which helps to shed light on this remarkable spate of police killings by officers of the state in recent months and years. Whereas the Spanish colonialists as early as the 1500s had begun to arm Africans. This was due in part to the fact, according to London, and this is London speaking, not Gerald Horn, that because Spanish was a Catholic country and enticed and encouraged so many young men into the priesthood, that there was a deficit of men that had to be made up by putting Africans in positions of importance and helping to build up the free Negro population. And keep in mind as well that after the U.S. takeover of the island, circa 1898, that the U.S. sought to impose a rigorous form of Jim Crow a la Dixie in Cuba, and that was one of the major bones of contention between islanders and Washington. And I argue in my book that that helps to give momentum to the overthrow of the U.S. neocolonial regime in 1959.
Do young Cubans, are they still aware of the history of U.S. Jim Crow in Cuba itself?
Well, I would hope so, and I think so. And the fact that it appears that my book, which deals at length with the subject, will be translated on the island, and already it's being read on the island by those who read English, I think that that is a sign that there is an acute awareness of U.S. Jim Crow. Keep in mind that part of the national identity of Cubans, and this is true of many countries, including Iran, by the way, part of their national identity is to be hostile to U.S. imperialism and all of its permutations. And that not only augurs well for the continued sovereignty and independence of Cuba, it also is a message to the besieged African population in North America to reach out to their allies on the island if this African population in North America is actually serious, which I hope and trust it is, about lifting the veil of oppression that has now entrapped us.
And while the United States is reestablishing diplomatic relations with Cuba, there's been no let-up in its subversion of Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, and other places in Latin America.
Well, let us hope that the U.S. rulers have learned a lesson from their failed policies in Havana. Let us hope that the U.S. rulers recognize that in given the current constellation of forces globally, with U.S. imperialism rapidly falling behind China and really not having an answer for many of China's initiatives, not only in Latin America but in Africa, that this will cause a sobering and agonizing reappraisal of their failed policies, and that will lead to an attempt to normalize relations and harmonize relations with the heroic countries you have just mentioned.
And of course, Cuba is, and it does not get credit for this, still remains so deeply involved at the grassroots level with the Haitian people that their doctors constitute the National Health Service for most of the poor people of Haiti.
Isn't that something? And interestingly enough, what you say about Haiti could be extended to a number of African countries. It could be extended to a number of Latin American countries. Even a giant like Brazil, one of the 10 largest economies in the world, President Dilma Rousseff felt compelled to call upon Cuban medics to help Brazil lift itself out of a health and medical crisis that still is besetting that giant South American nation. And for that and many other reasons, we continue to salute revolutionary Cuba.
Dr. Gerald Horn of the University of Houston. The Caribbean island nation of Haiti held its first elections in 4 years earlier this month. Brian Concannon observed the voting. He heads the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti.
In terms of election day itself, the elections had many serious problems. There were problems with just getting material out to voting sites. Some places did not even have voting centers that were supposed to be one. Former internally displaced persons camp with about 100,000 voters that had no voting sites. There are also problems with materials like the ink that you're supposed to put your thumb in that's supposedly indelible was stopped. That allowed people to vote twice. There were serious problems with observers where many parties were not able to get their observers credited, and parties close to the government seemed to not have those problems. There was also violence on Election Day that closed down several large voting centers throughout the country. The Electoral Council said that the relatively small number, that only 4% of voting centers were closed down, but there were observer reports reported fairly serious problems at close to 50% of the voting centers that they observed. In terms of the lead up to the election, probably the largest single problem was the growing level of violence, not systematic violence, but there were a lot of candidates who were attacked and shot at. Some of those rock attacks were shot at. Many electoral offices were burnt down, and that obviously affected people's confidence in the process and their willingness to vote. In terms of the candidates, it was the highest ever participation of political parties in Haiti's elections. I believe there's over 120 parties. And for the first time in a long time, progressive parties, especially the Famille-Lavalas party, which is traditionally Haiti's most popular, was allowed to participate. The last two elections, the Famille-Lavalas had been excluded for reasons that are not recognized by Haitian law. And so they were allowed to participate. There was a lot of exclusions of candidates on technical grounds that they didn't fulfill one of the requirements. Some of those exclusions are controversial, but it doesn't appear that the Electoral Council was following any particular political line in their disqualification.
Well, it seems like a big and very raggedy free-for-all. The Lavalas party, in previous elections, of course, has commanded huge majorities. From what you could see, from what you could discern, what's their level of support today?
It's hard to say for sure exactly what the Lavalas' current level of support is, and I think we'll find out as the electoral returns come in. The party has been subject to a lot of repression over the last 10 years. Many top leaders were jailed, executed, or killed. Many have been bought off by other parties. And so it's a little bit hard to ascertain their support. I expect that they are probably the most popular party, but in the end, the electoral results are going to show that.
Now, these were elections for the legislature, much of the Senate, and all of the lower house. Why have they been delayed so long? They should have occurred 4 years ago.
Yes, the elections have been delayed, and that's led to a lot of problems. Haiti has not had any parliament at all since January, and for the last 2 years, parliament has been unable to take hard decisions because of a lack of a quorum. And that situation happened mostly because Haiti's president did not want legislative oversight, and his supporters in the international community supported that decision. And what Haiti's president, his name is Michel Martelly, has been doing over the last 3 years is proposing a series of electoral councils to run the elections. None of them exactly comply with the Constitution. And so he makes these proposals. The opposition parties and civil society predictably object to that, and then that ends up stalling for another few months until he proposes another electoral council. And throughout this process, there's been fairly broad opposition within Haiti to those attempts to manipulate the elections, but similarly broad support for the international community, especially the United States, has been very open, criticizing those who are opposing the electoral manipulation and supporting President Martelly. The underlying problem is that President Martelly was basically put into office in 2011 because the State Department and the Organization of American States forced the Haitian Electoral Council to change some electoral results, which put President Martelly into the runoff election for president, which he apparently won. As a result, he doesn't have that much popular support. The turnout in the elections, mostly because Lavalas and others were not allowed to run, was extremely low, the lowest turnout in the Western Hemisphere since World War II. I believe it was about 20% in the second round and maybe 24% in the first round. So you have someone who doesn't have a lot of popular support, is basically kept in office by the international community, and neither the president nor the international community wanted the referendum on policies that legislative elections would have given. During this year, as you mentioned, you could have legislative and presidential elections, and by the time you get a new legislature installed, it's going to be, at best, the last month of President Martelly's time in office. So he has effectively escaped parliamentary oversight for his term. But there is an effort to allow his party to continue to be in office, even though President Martelly cannot run for another term. And there is deep concern in Haiti that the international community is also supporting that. If you look at some of the electoral incidents that happened on Sunday, most of the problems seem to disproportionately benefit President Martelly's parties. And he actually has two main parties that support him, with a lot of other parties that were created by his friends to support them. And the incidents that seemed to support President Martelly were, first of all, it looks like the largest share of the violence was committed by Martelly's supporters. Second, the electoral offices that were shut down appear to be in areas where the government has the most opposition. Third, there's public financing for the elections, and those public funds were only handed out a few days before the elections, too late to be really used in any campaigns. But in the meantime, if you look at the posters around the country, if you look at the large campaign events, expensive campaign events run by the presidential parties, it's clear that President Martelly's parties somehow got some money to run their campaigns, even though the official public financing wasn't distributed until too late. So there's a deep concern in Haiti that you have all these irregularities that seem to help the ruling party, and the international community has been fairly consistent in downplaying irregularities. During Election Day itself, you were getting reports on radios, televisions, internet, social media, from a broad array of Haitian observers, international observers, Haitian press, international press, pretty consistently saying there's lots of serious problems. At the same time, if you look at the websites and the Twitter feeds of the international community, whether it's the UN, whether it's the U.S. government, or the official organization of American States or European Union observer missions, they kept saying things are going well. In fact, the European Union observation mission put out a message saying that they are going very nearly normal. This is at a time where you had violence, you had burning down of voting centers, you had a large-scale intimidation. So this great concern in Haiti that what's happening is what they call it a coup d'etat electoral, that the government is going to try to stay in office by manipulating the elections, depressing opposition turnout, and that the international community is going to support that as it did in 2010.
Yes, you spoke of a huge displaced persons camp in which there were no voting places. And of course, displaced persons could be assumed to be displeased with the current regime.
I think that's right. And they're particularly concerned about the current government because that government keeps making promises, same type of campaign as promises it's making everywhere. And they have found that those campaign promises are completely empty. And they have also been betrayed by the international community that promised them much better in the wake of the earthquake. And they're stuck in very tough situations. And the other areas that are closed down tend to be poor neighborhoods, in poor urban neighborhoods in Port-au-Prince, where, again, there is great displeasure with the government policies. You did not see voter disruption in Papineauville, which is a wealthy suburb of Port-au-Prince, or any of the other more comfortable areas where the government gets more of its support.
And of course, this election took place in the midst of a crisis in the Dominican Republic, where Haitians are being, or people of Haitian descent, are being deported by the tens of thousands.
Yes, and there's actually more internally displaced persons camps being set up on the border with the DR, because lots of people have nowhere to go in Haiti. Many of them, neither they nor their parents or even their grandparents, were born in Haiti or even ever came there, and they've just been dumped across the border with nothing.
And how has that crisis affected the election in terms of being an issue?
It is, I think, galvanized critiques of the government, because the government did not step up and either provide any support for people who were deported, nor did it publicly criticize the Dominican Republic's efforts. This is a government that is very close to some influential people in the Dominican Republic, including some large contractors that got some extremely good no-bid contracts for earthquake response work. There's a big scandal where a prominent Dominican senator is being accused in the Dominican Republic in the courts of a massive kickback scheme involving Haitian contracts, and parts of the kickbacks were financing for President Martinez's campaign. And so it has been one more cause for complaint against the government that it's not standing up for its people, just as the Congregation government is not standing up to criticize UN policy in Haiti or the UN infliction of a cholera epidemic on Haiti, because basically the government is supported by the international community, not by Haitian public.
President Martelly has de facto at least been ruling by decree. He won't be around much longer, but what are the possibilities of his party still backed by those outside powers ruling effectively by decree after this election?
It will be hard for them to rule by decree because as part of this whole process, it does appear that there will be a legislature, a parliament, and so that you will fill most of the seats in government that have not been most of the elected seats in government that have not been filled. What the bigger concern is that these elections are going to be manipulated in a way that President Martelly and his supporters have a lot of seats in parliament. And one of the things that happened was that President Martelly, when he came into office, he didn't come on with a large political party. I mean, he had no prior political experience. When he became president, he really only had one person from his political party in parliament. But through patronage and other things, he was able to purchase the loyalty of many parliamentarians who weren't part of a large political party. Because remember, the largest party, Femi Ravalas, had been excluded. And so because it had been excluded, parliament was a mishmash of independent and small party people who were able to take advantage of Ravalas' exclusion to take power, which made them very vulnerable to being bought out. And there's a concern that now, if the president's party can win the presidency and a few seats in parliament, then it can buy off with perhaps international help or with covert financing from the Dominican Republic or whatever other means at its disposal. It can buy off members of parliament to push its program through parliament, even though it's not the program that Haitian voters would choose.
So what the United States and France and Canada and other foreign powers have succeeded in doing is establishing, if not a social base for their client, at least a basis for ongoing political strength for that party in Haiti.
It looks like that's happening. One of the things we're going to see is what really happens with the elections. You know, again, the party has some strength in the sense that it's put out some development projects and very carefully use those as ways of maximizing its political leverage. So there are many people who feel that they will personally benefit from that party continuing in the office, and they're going to continue to support it. And the question is just whether that strategy can work enough to have a decisive number of candidates. The lower the turnout, the more likely that's going to work. So if you suppress turnout and you have you have 20% of the people voting, a few very strongly interested supporters are going to make the difference. Whereas if you have a large turnout, it's more likely to reflect the general perspective of Haitian voters, which would be critical of the government.
And I suppose the other large question is the behavior and influence of the Ravalas party now that it has emerged from basically a de facto banning.
Yes, and I think that's going to be an interesting process to see. The party repression works by having so many of its leaders killed, exiled, arrested, and just a general repression of the party and its inability to compete in several electoral contests in a row. That has weakened the party in some important ways. And the question is just whether it has been able to rebuild its structure and whether it's able to inspire people to vote. One of the effects of the political repression over the last 15 years is that it has, to some extent, made Haitians less likely to trust democracy. They still, I think, have the same trust in principle. They understand that popular voting and grassroots organizing can lead to change. But every time they vote a progressive government into power, that government is undermined and overthrown by the international community. That makes many voters say, yes, I would ideally like a progressive government, but in the context of we're going to have this great pushback, often a violent pushback, by the international community and Haitian elites, do we want to put our country through that? And that's obviously a horrible choice for citizens to make, but it is unfortunately the result of, you know, the years of repression. And I think we're going to see with this election, and probably more, less in the first round, but more in the second round of the presidentials, the extent to which Haitian voters are able to have their idealism triumph their concerns about foreign interference with a progressive government.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.